Let me just say a little bit about my own background and why I've invited all of you here tonight. I've been teaching as a Waldorf practitioner since 1976, and I began for 5 years taking on a fifth grade with a group of children with special needs and developmental disabilities. And this group became what is now called, they became the foundation for the school in which our colleague Clara Pataki is teaching, the Otto Speck School, which is connected with the fellowship community in Chestnut Ridge. So we used the Waldorf methods, but at that time we were not an officially accepted Waldorf school. And I basically learned on the job. I had not had a training at that time. I still have not had a training. I took that group from grade 5 through grade 10. So that was unusual, also extending into the high school years. Most of them then went on to Green Meadow Waldorf High School, grade 11 and grade 12, and everybody graduated, and they've done just fine. After that, I was asked to take on a grade 1 at Green Meadow Waldorf School. So I did that. I stayed with that group for 8 years. Then I took another group from grade 5 through 8 for 4 years. Then I took 5 years off and was director of teacher training at Sunbridge College, now called Sunbridge Institute. Then I went back again to Green Meadow and took a group from grade 4 through grade 8. And that group graduated 7 years ago. So I've done 8th grade 4 times, done the upper grades altogether 4 times. And I would not consider myself to have any expertise in that area, but at least I have some experience. So what I want to share with you tonight are, as I said, the loneliness of the long-distance teacher. Why is it that 8th grade stands apart from the rest of the school? And how can we understand particularly the 8th grader, the 8th grader's parents, and our own role in this, so that this can be a year which is really a culmination and not a year in which it sometimes seems as though things are, you know, sort of falling apart or not going quite the right way. So here are some thoughts that I'd like to share with you. One is, if you remember way back, if you did it at all, going and teaching grade 1, we could say that we honor the 8th grade teacher for what he or she is, and we honor the 1st grade teacher for what he or she will become. So there's tremendous excitement around the 1st grade teacher, and sometimes a sense of, muted acceptance of the 8th grade teacher. Sometimes it seems as though you're a little bit invisible to your colleagues. And what are the factors that are involved here? Perhaps the most important one, which is usually not discussed very much, is that Rudolf Steiner's intention was to have a 7-year grade school. And then his wish was that the children would be going on to the kind of secondary schools that they had in Germany at that time, which had a kind of 8th grade beginning. But he was not permitted to do this because the state of Schwäbisch Gmünd, where the Waldorf school was located, told him, it's got to be 8 years because you're going to have factory children there, and after 8th grades, their education ends, and they go on to apprenticeship or straight into working in the factory in one way or another. So this was one of the many compromises that Steiner had to make in order to get the school started. And he certainly did everything possible to integrate grade 8 into the rest of the curriculum. But I would say that it was not 100% successful. It's like in that story, the six swans where the sister is able to disenchant all of her brothers and turn them back to being human beings again, but one of them still has a bit of the wing of the swan. He never quite loses that. It wasn't a completely successful reintegration back into their human bodies. And I think eighth grade has a little bit of that quality. There are some factors that are sort of, it has in common with other grades. I think it's safe to say that when you have an odd numbered grade, 1, 3, 5, and 7, we generally find there that Rudolf Steiner gave a carefully, tightly integrated curriculum for that grade. And I'd say another quality of those odd numbered grades is that they are very introspective, that the children contract a little bit. They go into themselves, and they tend to be taking a lot in and not necessarily giving forth so much. Whereas in the even numbered grades, 2, 4, and 6, and then by default grade 8 as well, it's much more an extroverted year, and the students tend to be giving back a lot of what they received the year or even the several years before. It's also, however, in these extroverted, even-numbered years that Steiner gave us curricula that were much less integrated, that were left much more open for us. It's a little bit like what Goethe said, God gave us the nuts, but he will not crack them for us. And so that's very true about the even-numbered curricula, that they're given to us those years. We have a lot of subjects to teach, but we sometimes have to stretch ourselves to see exactly how those subjects are related to each other. So there's another challenge of grade 8, that it's Steiner's intention was to end the grade school experience in a more inward way with an odd-numbered year. We think of the Chinese saying that odd numbers are the numbers of heaven, and even numbers are the numbers of earth. So we're in an earthly year in grade 8, when perhaps Steiner's intention was for it to be more of a heavenly year. Secondly, or thirdly, or fourthly, we're also in this respect breaking out of the 7-year rhythm that is so sacred in the grade school. All of the sevens, the 7 days of the week, and a host of other things that come in seven, we have an eighth year. And we could say that the spiritual beings who accompany the child for the first 7 years are not there in quite the same way. That the angels, of course, have already been withdrawing from the children, particularly as the strong astral forces come in sixth and seventh grade. So the angels are not present. They're not working with us nearly as intimately and enthusiastically as they might have in the earlier grades. The archangels, who are connected with the astral body, they are still present. And we really need to call on them. And they are the beings who thrive in group work. They're nourished by groups of human beings getting together. So the challenge there is how to keep that cohesive group of the class together, when in a way the archangels, though they are present, they're all also ready to pull away. They're pulling the child out into the world to become part of a larger group. And this is one reason that especially in the autumn, even if you have a Waldorf high school connected with your school, and I know your schools, most of you do not, but even if you do, in a school like Ann Shapiro School in Vermont or Kelly School in Portland, the children are going to be talking all autumn about wanting to get away from the Waldorf school, wanting to be part of a bigger school, a school where they could make new friends and have a more varied curriculum, have more choices. This is really not entirely a negative thing. It's really their response to their archangel who is pulling them away from the host school, pulling them away from you as well. And then finally, we have the third beings of the third hierarchy, whom Steiner invoked in the meditation he gave along with the foundations of human experience or study of man. He spoke about the Archai, who are very lofty beings. They're not connected to individual human beings. They're not especially connected to groups of human beings. Archai are connected to time. They are connected to the great rhythms of time that manifest in important beginnings and important endings. And here, once again, we are at a disadvantage because the Archai, who are in a way integrated, woven together with the Waldorf school, their intention was obviously 7 years in the grades. Otherwise, Steiner would not have spoken about that and made it just a given in his initial plan for the school. But we have 8 years, so those Archai also, in a way, are working, chomping at the bit, impatient for the new beginning. When are these kids going to get out of there? When are we going to let them start anew and find themselves without the help of the class teacher? So cosmically, the deck is stacked against the class teacher, which is another way of saying you sort of are on your own in this year. You cannot count on the kind of collegial or hierarchical support that was almost an assumption, something you could just assume in the first 7 years, though, of course, they had their difficulties as well. So this is very, very important for us to recognize that here we are working much more out of what is quintessentially human. Here we are going to make our contribution to Waldorf education. Here we are going to show the hierarchies what a human being left to his or her own devices can do. So it's a great challenge. And of course, as we know, not everybody is up to it. And the numbers are greater and greater and greater of those teachers who fall away or drop out or something comes up in their life where they just don't feel that they can take this final grade. So congratulations to all of you, and especially to those of you like Mark Jensen who've just joined or coming into the school brand new in eighth grade. Not an easy place to begin. Now, I want to say a little bit more about the developing child at this age, and once again, the kinds of challenges that we face in working with this age group. Some of you have heard me speak about the sixth grader, and if I may, hopefully not being too redundant, for those of you who haven't heard, I just would like to say a little bit about this. This is not something that Rudolf Steiner spoke about. This is my own research and my own experience, so you can take it with a grain of salt if you wish. But I think the enigma, this dilemma, this question that we have today, why so many teachers drop out, not even by eighth grade, but more often nowadays in grade six. Many, many teachers stop after grade five or definitely end their work with a class at the end of grade six. In fact, I'm still getting calls and emails right now. Here we are in late July from schools who need teachers in grade six or grade seven. So this is where the big challenge is for many people. Why should this be? Well, one reason that people leave is because they're fired. And the reason that they're fired is usually because their class has suddenly been cut in half or two-thirds. Two-thirds of the children have just left out of the blue. And the assumption is, of course, it must be that you're a terrible teacher and therefore we can't keep you. We're going to lose money on this class. This happens to some schools year after year after year. And every year they just assume it's because the teacher was so bad that we can't go forward. There's got to be something wrong with this picture. There has to be another factor that's working into this, because this affects schools whether they're large and established and are 50 or 60 years old. It affects schools that are having their first 6th, 7th grade, and all the schools in between as well. And I would like to propose that this is actually the issue. It's not necessarily, and very often it has nothing whatsoever to do with the quality of the teacher. Rather, it has to do with the particular change that a child goes through between ages 12 and 13. And what's happening at this point is that the etheric body is pulling back. It now has the work of developing the organs, particularly the endocrine system, so that puberty and early adolescence can take place. So the etheric body is now fairly weak in terms of its ability to meet the onslaught of the astral body. And the astral body comes now with a vengeance. And it wages a virtual war on the etheric forces. Steiner speaks about this battle in his lectures called Balance in Teaching. And he says that the child is virtually a battlefield between these etheric and astral forces. And 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, the etheric is definitely on the losing end of that battle because it has other work to do. It's giving its last best efforts to strengthening the physical body and helping the child go through the huge growth spurt of this age. So the astral body comes, it brings a whole host of problems, issues, some very good things as well. But most importantly for the sixth grader, it is the astral body that covers individual karma. That is how the individual's karma is carried. It's not the physical body, and it's not the etheric body. Those bodies are the model bodies given by the parents. The child's own karma is only present when the astral body incarnates, which it begins to do very rapidly between ages 12 and 13. So what's happened for the first 5.5 grades is that the child has been carried in the womb, or at least in the arms or the stroller, of the parents' karma. That is to say, for those grades, it's the parents who had karma with you, not the child. The child is just going along in the same way that when a pregnant woman walks into a room, she's bringing the unborn child with her. The child doesn't have much choice about going into that room. It's there, like it or not. It's the same with the class. It is the parents who bring the child there in nursery, kindergarten, or first grade. It is the parents who keep the child there. And it's only in the middle of sixth grade and thereafter that the child suddenly has to determine whether he or she has a karmic connection with you that is his or her own karmic connection. This is huge. This is why, on the one hand, children sometimes decide they don't want to be in your class. They actually don't like you. They don't feel a connection with you. This is why, even when the child does feel they have a connection with you, the parents will insist that you are withdrawing from them, that you don't like them anymore, that you never call them, you never have anything to do with them, you ignore them, on and on and on. and they feel very hurt or they feel very offended, and now the seeds get sown in which they're deciding if you don't like them, they don't need you, and they're going to pull their child out of the class. How do we deal with this? Well, for one thing, this is too late for you anyway. Sorry, better luck next time. But in fifth grade, it's important to start talking to the parents about this change. When I talk to my parents, I use the terms karma and everything. I mean, it's the only way to explain it. Otherwise, it's all a big riddle. And I told them that when a sixth grader starts to say, I don't like my teacher, or I hate my teacher, or my teacher hates me, that in the early grades, a parent should say to the child, don't talk that way about your wonderful teacher. She loves you. You should be grateful for her. In sixth grade, the parent should begin to listen to that. And if they hear it more than once, they should call you up and have a conversation with you about it. Maybe it's a good thing for the child to visit another school. Maybe that child is really looking for the next teacher that he or she should have. And it's not a bad thing if one-third of the class leaves somewhere between the beginning of sixth grade and the end of seventh grade, even half the class. I have seen perfectly healthy situations where two-thirds of the class left, and that was not the end of the world because the group that stayed were strongly connected to the teacher. And on the other hand, there should be new children coming who have decided that their teacher is not the one that they want, and now they're looking for you. This is why it is so wonderful in places like Northern California, where Mark's school is, Sebastopol. There are about 13 Waldorf schools, all an hour and a half away from San Francisco. Parents can pick and choose. Children can pick and choose. They can decide at one point that their present teacher isn't the right one, and they can go to another Waldorf school and find the class teacher whom they really need to meet in grade 6 or 7. So that's what's going on in these three upper grades. There are gigantic karmic transformations going on, and there's a huge adjustment of the karma of the class. Now you cannot take any parent in that class for granted. You have to recultivate them all over again and work with them on a new level. Now they're going to be meeting you and staying with you in freedom. No longer is it just because they have this tight karmic connection and they have no way of, you know, getting around it, no way of not dealing with you. Now there's freedom there. And that's a very, very wonderful experience. But on the other hand, you have to keep cultivating them, because otherwise they will feel that loosening of their karma with you and they will start to disappear. The numbers of parents who show up in meetings start to diminish unless you make those meetings irresistible. The phone calls you get from parents sharing with you concerns start to diminish unless you are calling them, and so on and so on. This is a very, very different level of work that must go on at this time. So parent work becomes a new challenge. And you shouldn't feel, oh, they're not showing up in the parent evenings because they trust me. You know, they know I'm doing a great job. They don't have to come and barrage me with questions. It's not that way at all. If anything, they've lost their trust in you, and they have to meet you all over again. You have to regain that trust on an entirely new level. So this is a very big challenge. And I will share with you Wednesday and Friday, I'll share with you some ways of building up this trust. Tonight, I just want to sort of delineate the different issues that face you. All right, so the children have changed profoundly. You are definitely going to have a core group, which might be a very small number, who really have a karmic connection with you. And I can't tell you how many schools I have visited where the eighth grade teacher says to me with a very sad face, "All of the wonderful children left. The only ones I have remaining in my class are the difficult ones, the ones with problems, the kids who can't get into another school even if they tried." And my feeling is, yeah, and the ones for whom you are destined. This is your karmic group. You know, deal with it. So this is very important to realize, you know, that you are getting the children in eighth grade with whom you have your deepest connection, whether it may appear that way or not. Of course they're going to be challenging. Of course they won't always be the so-called golden children. Those children need you like a hole in the head. They can do wonderfully anywhere in any school setting. But it's the children who need Waldorf, who could not survive in another school, they are going to tend to be the core group in eighth grade. And that's good for them, and it's very good for you. Now, I'll just take a sip of water, and I want to say something about your colleagues. So as I said before, you can't count on your colleagues' support in the same way that you had it before. And I hope that some of you are thinking as I'm saying this, he doesn't know my colleagues. He doesn't know my school. You know, we are so incredibly tight and supportive. And I don't doubt it. And I'm not denying that there are such schools. I've heard legends of them again and again. I haven't experienced too many myself. But anyway, I've only visited 150 schools over the years, and I'm sure there are one or two. But let's, again, look at what's going on in eighth grade. Number one, most of your colleagues have never been in eighth grade. Probably you've never been in eighth grade before. Maybe this is your second time, possibly your third time. But, you know, it's a rarity. It's very, very rare for most Waldorf teachers to go through eighth grade more than a couple of times. So you're unique. You're going through a set of experiences, this sense that, you know, this is the last year. What am I going to do? I can't hand anything over to next year in my reports. What am I going to do? So you are living in a very different space. You're living in a much more intensified karmic connection with your children, with a looser karmic connection with your parents. The parents with complaints may not be talking to you as openly as they did in the past. Where are they going? They're probably going to your colleagues. Maybe, you know, the child in your class has a sibling or two in fifth grade, in second grade, and the parents are going to go to your colleagues and complain about you to them, and possibly to the administrator, but that's an entirely different issue. So your colleagues may be hearing along the grapevine a very different picture of you than the one that you tend to present in faculty meetings. And this is going to create a little bit of uneasiness and distancing. It's unlikely they're going to go up to you and say, "Well, you know, Mrs. Jones just came up to me and was complaining about you." They're probably going to feel, "I can't do that to him. He's, you know, he's going through hell as it is. Just let him be." So that's one thing, that the parents are starting in a way to create a kind of web which is not necessarily entirely positive, and this is something that gets picked up by your colleagues. Something else that's very important, you are at times going to make of yourself a royal pain in the neck in the midst of your colleagues. What do I mean by this? Excuse me for being so frank. You are going to really irritate them, and you are going to just upset them terribly. I'm telling you this in advance, and I'm telling you it's almost inevitable. Why? Because of two things. Because of fundraising and because of your class trip. Three things. And your class play. Because you are getting into such time-consuming, such all-consuming activities with raising money, hosting a class trip, and producing a class play, it's going to take time. It's going to take an unexpected, unprecedented amount of time, and you're going to start missing committee meetings with the lame excuse, oh, we needed another rehearsal. Oh, my God, I had to meet with the parents about the fundraiser. It almost isn't going to happen. Or, oh, a committee meeting. Oh, I forgot. You know, I'm so obsessed with the class trip. I'm so sorry. So number one, you're going to be completely undependable. It's like you're going to have early onset of Alzheimer's, which is part of being an eighth grade teacher. Number two, your class is going to start to run roughshod over everybody else's rights in the school. That is to say, they're going to want to have three bake sales a week because they realize they're $4,000 short in the money that they need to raise. So suddenly, the eighth grade is having a bake sale every other day, and these poor little children are being forced to bring $1 or $2 to school every day. The parents are very upset. All that sugar that their children are eating, you know, how many times a week does my child need to have pizza and soda with it? But the eighth graders won't stop. They're fearless, they're bold, they're reckless. Bake sale, fundraising, fundraising. When the class play begins, they need places to rehearse. They just are in the hall screaming out their lines. They go outside when the other children are trying to have a little quiet game. And there again, they're screaming out their lines. They barge into classrooms and take over because they need rehearsal space. Or they cannibalize the costumes that other classes have made for their class plays. They rip off sets. The whole story. You've already seen this happening with your other colleagues and their eighth grades, perhaps. Just be careful about this. And lastly, of course, you have these unannounced, unscheduled rehearsals or field trips that you decide on in the last moment, and the specialist teachers show up. They're part-time. They're not in the meetings. They didn't know about it. They show up ready to teach your class, and there's a note on the door. Sorry, we're gone. They're going to hate you. They will hate you so deeply by the end of the year. They may not even want to show up at your graduation. So that's how it goes. In spite of your best wishes, I know every one of you are you're very good people with tremendous integrity. You would never intentionally do such potentially socially disruptive, even destructive things to your colleagues, and yet I can almost guarantee you, you will do that. And that will also open up the gap between you and your colleagues and make you feel very, very alone. And of course, your students are going to want to have special privileges attendant only on eighth grade. Maybe there's already a tradition, you know, the eighth graders are allowed to cross the street and buy lunch at the local sandwich store. Nobody else in the school is allowed to do that. The eighth graders, when they have recess, are allowed just to sit at the picnic tables and not do anything. Nobody else can do that. The eighth graders are allowed to sit and eat lunch outside. No one can do that, and so on and so on and so forth. So the other children get very indignant, complain to their teachers, who in turn complain to you. The rudeness of your students, the violation of the flagrant violation of dress code again and again, the violation of rules about dyeing hair, earrings in all kinds of orifices, tattoos, you name it. The eighth graders are constantly pushing the envelope, and you are held responsible. And once again, your colleagues get tired of having to constantly come to you with all of those complaints. So that's something else that leads to that loneliness of the long-distance teacher. These real challenges that come up in eighth grade, perhaps some of them were there in seventh, even a bit in sixth, but they come to a kind of apogee, a real point in eighth grade, and it's partly because the students are feeling this is our last year. You know, we're going to have it all. Let's take advantage of this. There won't be any consequences anyway. They feel incredibly emboldened and incredibly entitled. And this is something that you really have to work with. So I will give you right now, you know, a few thoughts about taking on this sort of three-headed dragon, this troika, this wild troika running off without you holding the reins at times, and how to deal then with the challenges of the children, of the parents, and of your colleagues. So in terms of the children, it's very, very important that you and your colleagues work out right at the beginning of the school year, which would mean in your August preparation time, what the colleagues' concerns are about eighth grades in the past. And you may be aware of these as well. Now, what sort of rules should be there? What kinds of borders, what envelope do you want to have wrapped around this eighth grade class? And then you have to be willing to strongly work with that, not to make exceptions, not to feel sorry for your poor, suffering, innocent children, but you really have to be there as a real ego for the class. They have to sense that when you make a decision, that decision is written in stone, that there are not exceptions to the rule. And sometimes, you know, you're going to find yourself sawing off the limb you're sitting on when it comes time to enforce a rule. So only make those rules and those policies that can really be enforceable. How can you strengthen your ego forces? Well, one way is the path that Rudolf Steiner gives of meditation and self-development. There we're talking about something that takes years and years, even lifetimes. But one way that you can do that right now, this summer, is to develop your sense of interest in the world around you. That is to say, to recognize where you as a Waldorf person may be asleep. What is it that you're, you know, really not aware of? What isn't interesting you? And develop some strong interest. And to give you a couple of thoughts about this, what kind of music were your seventh graders listening to? Do you listen to that music yourself? Have you ever kind of downloaded it from iTunes just to hear what they're hearing? What kinds of movies are they going to? Have you spent any time this summer going to some of the movies that they're very likely going to go to as well, or have already gone to most likely before you? Are your students involved in social media, even though that may be against the law in your school? Are they doing it anyway? What do you know about social media? What have you experienced of it? Are you aware of the various pitfalls and temptations that are out there? So there are some areas of interest for you to cultivate this summer. You can do it very, very quickly. Try to imagine what your eighth graders are doing this summer, and you try to do it too, so that when you come back and school begins, you can have some non-judgmental discussions about what they're up to. And they can see that, like the Jesuits, you are in the world, though not of it. This will mean a tremendous amount to them, that you are getting interest in, you're getting interested in their world. And they'll see you truly as a person who can learn, who can really go forward. I would also urge you early on in eighth grade that you and your class all see a movie together. It may be a movie that you all go to see in a theater, if there's anything that you really would want to do that, that's worth seeing. Usually there isn't. or at least that you all get a parent to host you so that you can use one of their gigantic screen home theater TVs, and you can all watch a video, maybe of a Laurence Olivier Shakespeare drama, or some great classic movie, or something that's connected to matters in the curriculum, the American Revolution, or the French Revolution, or the Scientific Revolution, or something like that. I would urge you to do this 3 or 4 times during the year, that you go to the children's level and watch a movie with them. And your presence, your being there, will bring a kind of ego presence which will be very meaningful to them and will show them that you are, you know, you really want to get to know them better, that their world means something of you. That will help them take an equal and opposite step of getting increasingly interested in your world, that is to say, the world of the eighth grade curriculum. And of course, the whole curriculum this year is one that's designed to cultivate your interest in many subjects with which you ordinarily might not have come in common. The history in particular is very complex and brings you into a number of subjects in which you probably have very little prior knowledge. So that, again, is already building up the capability and the interest that you have. One thing that you've got to be very careful about this year, two things really, but they're two sides of the same coin. The class trip and the fundraising that leads up to the class trip. Increasingly, eighth grade class teachers are becoming glorified fundraisers, that they are teaching less and less as maybe the Waldorf High School sends a math teacher in to make sure that the student's math is up to par. So you don't have to do any math. That gives you some free time to figure out how to raise some money. Or it may be that a language arts specialist has joined the lower school faculty and is taking over for you. A dad who's good at physics does your physics block, whereas a mom who's an expert on the French Revolution does your history block. Such things happen. And then the class teacher's basic work is figuring out ways to raise money and money and more money and figure out ways to make class trips that are ever more exciting and that raise the ante over what last year's class did and the class the year before did. And unfortunately, this becomes far too much of a focus for eighth grade classes in the Waldorf School. It pushes away a lot of important time in the main lesson that should be spent working hard on these complex and profound subjects that are part of the eighth grade curriculum. And instead, the talk, the concern is just money, money, money. How to bring that money and how to raise the thousands of dollars because we've decided we're going to fly there. And when we arrive, a luxurious bus will be waiting and the bus will take us then to the port where the yacht is waiting. Whatever it is, the trips often get absolutely absurd. And it's good if you perhaps are the first eighth grade teacher in your school's history to try to bring some sense into this whole matter and to realize how much energy and how much stress gets connected with this whole issue. Class trips can be very, very simple. Pedagogically, they are of such little value compared to any single main lesson. Socially, yes, they have an important role to play. On the other hand, teachers often assume that the class trip is just going to be the cure-all for all the social problems. You know, that having a few adventures together is suddenly going to turn around 5 or 6 or 7 years of groups of children not getting along well, of cliques and bullying and so on. it doesn't happen. It happens in a very short-term way, but it's not the real thing. So it's perhaps the time is coming now, especially with the difficulties in the U.S. economy, for us to look at the class trip in a fresh way. And maybe we have to take the risk of being the first class teacher to really ask some deep and serious questions about why the eighth grade has to get so obsessed about bake sales and pizza sales and fundraisers and lasagna dinners and charging admission for its class play and selling artwork, whatever classes have to do to raise those thousands and thousands of dollars. Is this really what we want their memory to be of the very last grade? Because they are so extroverted, because so much in eighth grade is looking out into the world, as the verse implies, it's easy enough to fall into the trap. So be very, very careful about that. Now, in terms of parents, on Wednesday, I'm going to be giving you some plans that you can carry out that can turn around even the most difficult and antipathetic group of parents, individuals or whole groups. I will give you some keys to do this. It will take work, but it is definitely something that can be done, even in just a few months' time. Eighth grade doesn't give you a whole lot of time. And lastly, with colleagues, we're going to look at them again as we look at the phenomenon that I like to call the incredible disappearing class teacher. But we'll take that up on Wednesday. Okay, now if any of you have questions, I think that, let me see, I think that I can see them now. If anybody wants to push five star, I should be able to see it. And I'm going to unmute everyone. So it's going to mean then that, okay, Clara has a question. And someone down at the bottom whose name I don't have. Okay, let me first get Clara on. Okay, Clara, go ahead.
You mentioned that the class teacher should be interested in the world of the child. And I was thinking you mentioned about movies and music, and I just realized that my student is very much into video games. It's his way of, of the connection. And
yes,
how do you feel about video games? Because it's hard for me. I mean, I can get interested into music and movies and whatever they read, but not into video games. And I still understand that he has a need to do that because it's not like any normal child, and in a certain way he's allowed to do that. But on the other hand, it's hard for me as a teacher to get into video games, and I don't know how to approach this.
Clara, I'm very glad that you asked that question. It's extremely important.
Conference
because
muted.
It is the video game is becoming for boys what, you know, the basketball team was, or the joining the softball team. For many boys, this is now becoming the equivalent of sports, and it is also for many boys the equivalent of a rite of passage, which our culture doesn't give them anymore. Going through the dark woods, going through the labyrinth, having to go into a building in which there are all kinds of dangers, and meeting all kinds of nefarious creatures or possibilities, which are all, of course, reflections of yourself. That particularly where a child is having developmental issues and, you know, has need for a special education, it would be very good for you to join in on that video game to see what it's like, to see what's going on. It's not just murder, murder, murder. there are whole levels of challenges that are in it, which are actually speaking to something that our culture simply doesn't give young people. In my own activity, you know, trying to understand what those video games provide,
conference muted.
What I've experienced was when I worked in Ruskin Mill in England and did glass blowing, and I saw what the experience was like in glass blowing, where you are risking your life at every moment. You're dealing with glass that's, you know, 1,000 degrees. It's molten. It's fiery red. You're blowing air into it. You can't breathe in or you're going to kill yourself. It's such risks. You've got to be multitasking, and you've got to be watching everybody around you, because you could easily place your hot glass too close to them. That world of craft, however, it's not vouchsafed for young people, and particularly young men anymore. The question is, can we penetrate the video game, and can we find a way of beginning to redeem that? And I think until Waldorf teachers get involved in such games, there won't be any redemption, and the students will just get into them, and there'll be no feeling of somebody looking over their shoulder, giving them some advice, guiding them a little bit in it. You know, we've come to understand that when a student sees a movie, it's really good if they can talk it over with us, that they can process it. But we're not doing that with video games. And I think it's making them more and more of a black hole for students. So I urge you, find out what you can, download yourself some free video game or whatever. There's a video game called Civilization, which might be worth looking into. It's almost like a kind of caricature Waldorf version of a video game. So that might be something worth looking into. I'm a voice in the wilderness. There's not a single other person in the Waldorf world, I think, who would give you this advice. But I think otherwise we're going to lose a lot of our boys, just as we're losing the girls to social media because we disapprove of that in it. We may, you know, be losing both genders, but the boys in video games are a very powerful combination.
Excuse me, can you repeat the name of the video game?
It's called Civilization, of all things. You would think that a video game is a very antipathy of civilization, but that's what it is. It's a very interesting game.
So it's simply Civilization, that's it?
Civilization by Sid Meier is the name of the creator. I think it's M-E-I-E-R. A little bit like the arithmetic Retea Mir, but with one other E in it. One of my M-I-E-I-R. It is a very, very interesting game in which you have to create a whole civilization dealing with all kinds of warriors and conflicts. But have a look at it. Very often you can get older versions of these games very inexpensively. Someone else had a question, and I don't have a name next to this. It's 425949. Who is that?
Hi, Eugene, that's me, Michael Preston.
Okay, Michael, what is your question?
It wasn't a question so much as saying that I totally agree with you about the eighth grade trip. I have five eighth grades myself. And the solution seems to be that the school gives the teacher a platform of about $500 per child, and then you only need to raise a little bit of money on top of it. And that way you can get on with actually teaching your curriculum through the year.
That is a very good idea. Of course, many schools say we can't afford that, that we can't give anything for the trip, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think that's a very, very good idea. Remove at least money from it so that it's something that can go back to teaching. Thank you. Well, if you'd like, if anyone has a question, I'd be happy. Would you like me to go on and talk about working with parents? First of all, I want to mention that every one of these evenings we have together is being recorded. So even if you didn't quite hear something that well, or if your connection faded out for a while, or if your connection just ended completely and you missed part of the conference, it will be recorded and it will be online, and that should be available very soon, I think within 24 hours. And of course, I'll let you know in the next phone call if that's available. And I also just want to make sure that everybody is availing themselves of the web page. And I added a little bit more this morning, some links that might be of interest to you connected with geometry and math. Okay, parent work. Now, once again, some of you have heard me talk about this in conferences that I've done in the early grades. The earlier you start this, like first grade, the better. But it works no matter when you start it. And this is what I want to share with you. It came from my most recent class that I took up in fourth grade, a very difficult, very, very challenging class, with, as is only to be expected, a very difficult, very challenging group of parents. I knew them very, very well because I was a parent in that class as well. My stepdaughter was in that class. So I had no illusions about them. So now suddenly I'm the new teacher and I have to prove myself to them. They've only known me as a parent and one who was director at Sunbridge. Now I have to show I can also be a teacher of their children. So it was really not easy at all taking on this group. And I noticed whenever I would call somebody up, especially the parent of a boy, it might be to remind them that there was a class meeting the next week or to remind them about one thing or another. Their comment to me was, just a minute, let me sit down. Or, hold on, let me get my heart remedy. They were terrified. The teacher was calling. That meant bad news. That meant their child was on the verge of getting suspended or expelled or whatever. And I thought, this is terrible. I can't work with them for the next 5 years like this. So at the time, there was a book that was getting very popular among business people, and it was called The 1 Minute Manager. And it was about how the most successful CEOs would put on hard hats and go down to the factory floor, and they had these 1 minute praisings that they prepared. So it didn't take long. They just go up to every guy on the assembly line, or at least all the managers, all the shop stewards, and give them a 1 minute hymn of praise, tell them something positive. And then they'd go on to the next and on to the next. And they said in this way, the morale on the assembly line floor was raised incredibly, and productivity went up, and union and management negotiations were easier, and so on and so forth, all because people saw the CEO and they saw him in a positive way, and they saw that he cared about them. So I worked out a way in which to adapt this to work with parents. And this is what I did. Every day, I would carefully observe. Now, at this time, I had a class. Let's talk about eighth grade. I had a class of 31 eighth graders. I would observe three students every day, very, very carefully. I had a list of who I'd observe day by day. I'd look at the way they were dressed. I'd look at, how awake or asleep they were. I'd also purposely ask them more questions see how they were doing in mental arithmetic or in their review of our history class, how they were doing in their main lesson book. Then I would write several sentences about each of those students, two or three sentences right after main lesson in my little PhiloFax book. So I had notes on those three students, the next day, three different students, the day after that, and so on. Now, that's what I did in the morning, carefully observe those students. At the very end of the day, those three students became the subjects of my contemplation of the class, or so-called meditation, meditating on your students. I could not meditate on 31 students. I would have been up all night. Instead, I would let these three students, who I observed very carefully, stand for the whole class. You know, the part represents the whole. So that also streamlined my meditative work on the class. But in between main lesson and nighttime, when I'm about to go to sleep, one other thing came up. In the evening, about this time in the evening, round about 8 o'clock, I would make a call to the homes of those three students. And I'd make the calls 3 minutes long, no more than 5 minutes long. And each of those calls was in three parts. Number one, I would say something positive, even funny, about their... I would dredge up something that would be amusing to them, reassuring to them, show them that their child's making progress. That's not always an easy thing to do on any given night, but that's very important, so that they know that most of the time when you're calling them, it's a good thing. You're calling them for a good reason. The second part of the call, I'd say to them, what is your son or daughter saying about school these days? When she comes home, does she say anything about school? Usually the parents would say, yeah, she's kind of enjoying the French Revolution, or he's finding the chemistry class really different from seventh grade. It's just, it's much harder. It's much more complicated. And is he doing all right? You know, they'll share very interesting things, and that's great. Sometimes they'll say she's not saying anything. But sometimes they will say, you know, Eugene, I didn't want to bother you because you always look so tired. I know how busy you are and so on. But I've been meaning to tell you, and that's very important. When they're meaning to tell you something and they would not have told it to you except for the fact that you've called them up and asked them, and then it might be that you hear of a problem. That there's bullying, there's cliquishness, there was an incident on the school bus, there's a rumor that somebody's smoking or drinking or whatever. This is very important. If you get it from the parent that night, you may have to make a few more calls to other children who may be involved in this, to their parents. Much better to get it in a 3 or 5 minute phone call than for it in a week or two to spread like wildfire among the parents and turn into a crisis. Eighth grade is the year of crises waiting to happen, because the parents have distanced themselves from you, because the children are more deeply wound up with your astrality. Your astral body and their karma are kind of in sync with each other. And it doesn't take much. If you ever see that remarkable, brilliant play by Arthur Miller, The Crucible, you see how easy it is for these things to spread virally, as they say. And in fact, the internet, with its viral quality, is a perfect place, a perfect culture for these very ill astral remnants to spread around. If you are in touch with your parents, if you're communicating with them, you probably can avoid most, if not all, eighth grade crises. That's how simple it is to do. but you need the discipline of making these phone calls. But there's a third part of the phone call as well, no less important than the first two. So the first part of the call is you share something about the child. The second part is you ask how the child is doing, what the child is bringing home. Are the parents having any problems with home with the child? Can't always tell. Things are very different at this age, home and school. Part three is you say to that mom or dad, and how are you doing? How's your life? And there you're going to get an earful sometimes. Eighth grade can be a year of the golden year of separations and divorces. It's astonishing how many families split up sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, but particularly in eighth grade. Or it's also a year of real crisis where the parents' karma with one another is also going through changes. You know, the parents, whatever the children are going through, the parents are going through as well in a very profound way. And Steiner tells us that up to about age 14, that is up to eighth grade, the mother and the biological child have an umbilical cord, an astral umbilical cord that's still connecting them. But right at this age, that umbilical cord is severed. And this is very painful for the mother. It's like having to suddenly wean her child, or it's like giving birth. And there's a real labor period. So parents are often going through tremendous ups and downs at this time. And of course, if the child is sensing this and giving them a hard time or exploiting it or manipulating it, then it's easy enough for the parents to say, it must be the teacher. You know, the teacher can't control her, and there she brings it home. She projects it on us. So there again, find out how things are between the parents. And this will help explain how things are with the child. And also, and no less importantly, it will give the parent the sense that you still care about them, that you still love them, that you haven't forgotten that they exist. And I would say the further west you go in North America, the more important this is, that the parents feel that you love them as much as you love the children. On the East Coast, parents are a little more chilly, and they can handle the distancing a little better, but not in the West, certainly not in California. And I know those of you who teach in California schools, I'm probably not telling you anything you don't already know. But these phone calls are as good as gold. In fact, I will give you back the full tuition for this conference, that royal sum of $150, if you carry out what I've just explained to you, these three-minute phone calls, night after night throughout the school year, five nights a week, if you have the discipline to do that, if you do that and you have a crisis in your class anyway, your money is given back to you. Because I can promise you, if you do this and are disciplined about it, it's simple, but it's not easy. But if you carry it out, your eighth grade will not have crisis, and you will have tremendously good relationships to most, if not all, of your parents. Okay, any questions about that? So I've unmuted it, if anyone wants to say anything or ask about that.
Eugene, I have a question for Chris.
Yes.
I've learned the very hard way about the pitfalls of using email with parents. What's your thought about emailing parents in eighth grade?
Well, thank you for that great question. I have spoken about phone calls. That's as far as I would go. Emails are, let me mute again so you can hear me better.
Conference muted.
Emails right now are in the same place where the printing press was in the 15th century. That is to say, the printing press was basically used for people to insult one another, and it was out of control. People did not know how to deal with their ability to write something and send it all over Europe within a few weeks. You know, there was just such an incredible power that anyone had. And Luther and the popes used this, of course, as you'll teach the children in the Reformation, to create nothing but polemics. So that was the basic use of the printing press, very negative. That's what email is like right now. The only thing I'd ever use email for is, you know, remember next week's bake sale, and don't forget our parent evening in 2 weeks, and here's a list of people who are responsible for refreshments. That's about as far as I would go. Otherwise, it's too powerful. It moves with the speed of light, not the speed of sound, the way a phone call does. And, you know, unless the parents are secretly recording your phone calls and playing it over for others, they cannot convey to others accurately what you said. And people realize that they're getting word of mouth, they're getting hearsay. However, when they see an email that you wrote that was meant for one person and has now gone out to everybody in the class, then that's very destructive. Try to avoid it. Anyone else have some questions, comments? Clara.
Yes, I was just thinking that because I have one student or possibly two, how many times would you suggest phone calls, like once a week?
Oh, that's a good question. Of course, I'd say when I was teaching in your school, there were some weeks when I would call up
muted
every single night because the children had such special needs and, you know, their behavior was so volatile and unpredictable that it was really good for us to be in touch every night. So I would say, you know, I don't think there's any harm in calling the parent of that one or two child or children twice a week. I'd say twice a week, and you may now and then need to do it more. You know, it's better that they get bored hearing from you than that they feel you never call them. If you have to err in one direction, it's better to overdo the communication rather than underdoing it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, Mark.
Okay. A question coming from a smaller community school with sixth grader. I use technology extensively even in those younger grades, and I'm wondering about your thoughts and the Waldorf movement and acceptance in general on using technology in the classroom, PowerPoints and word processing and other computer skills.
Okay. Well, just let me mention, for the sake of who Mark is and not everyone else does, Mark is teaching in a charter school in Sebastopol, California, and he's coming from another non-Waldorf charter school where he's been teaching, from what I hear, very successfully. And now he's joining the Sunridge Charter School, Waldorf Charter School, Waldorf-inspired, in eighth grade. So this is all very new to him. I should also mention something about Sebastopol, California. Throughout North America, the percentage of children in Waldorf schools in North America is 1/50 of 1% of the children in America go to Waldorf schools. The percentage of children in Sebastopol, California, who go to Waldorf and Waldorf-inspired schools is 25%. There's no other community like it, perhaps, in the world, even in Germany, where a quarter of the children in this rather large community of a lovely town go to the Waldorf school. So he's in quite a place there. So, Mark, in terms of technology and the and using in the Waldorf school, and I said that schools are very, very conservative, and in fact, this has become a very big national issue because last school year, the New York Times wrote a very big article about the Waldorf School of the Peninsula located in Los Gatos in the heart of Silicon Valley and showed how many Apple employees and Google employees send their kids there because they don't want them using computers and they don't want them in a high-tech environment. So I think there's something to be said for that, that Waldorf schools tend to wait a long, long time. High schools introduce computer use, and high schools will show students videos, and high school students at some point will even be able to make their own PowerPoints to present things. But I would say on the whole, try to do without that. It may be in your school there's an openness to trying it a little bit, but I would proceed very carefully and maybe even stay in touch with the teachers who are in this conference because people are open to giving their emails and things like that. Stay in touch with people. This might be a very good thing for you all to correspond about or to blog about. Do you want to work with these things? So I would say on the whole, probably not. Probably that's something you're going to have to wait to do. Other questions or comments?
Can I ask on that topic of technology?
Yes, sure.
We've had a bit of a – our school is pretty new. We just graduated our first eighth grade class last year. This is Portland Village School in Portland, Oregon. And we've had some kind of discussion between the upper grades teachers about how much to let students use technology when they're doing projects related to the curriculum, reports and research papers in terms of, using the internet for research or – typing their papers versus handwriting them. I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
I think in eighth grade, at home, or in the library, in fact, because more and more libraries, particularly west of the Mississippi, are basically selling their books and becoming mostly computer-based, so that a student goes into the library and has to be pretty comfortable with searching online or at least searching in the library's network for things. I think that's almost inevitable. And I don't think there's any harm in the students doing some internet research if you want them to do papers and things like that at home. In a couple of my slideshows, I speak about research and projects and whether they're worthwhile doing, but if you are doing it, then you have to expect inevitably that students are going to be going online. The important thing about their work online is for you to teach them to discriminate between things that are edited, like a book to get published, at least in theory, there's an editorial board that works for the publisher. The publisher has a reputation. The publisher wants to make sure that the author knows what he or she is talking about and so on. On the internet, anybody can write anything, and billions of people will believe it because they see it in print or they see it illustrated with a video, which they think is real, even though it may be completely false. So this could be a good educational moment for you to work with your students on media and how easily things can be edited in media, in the sense that a film is edited and things are put together to make it look like they're happening at the same time when that isn't the case. Or somebody writes something and claims that they are part of a university or part of a research group or something. And for the students to learn then that they're in a world on the internet, which is like the dark forest of the fairy tale. And just because you meet somebody holding a light, it doesn't mean they're good. And just because they're beautiful, it doesn't mean they're good, you know? So I think taking them through this world a bit can be a very beneficial experience, that they don't just sort of download stuff that they, or cut and paste things that they don't understand at all.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, I think, Clara, did you have a question?
Yes, but it's not related to technology. It's related to the meditative practice of the teacher.
Well, I think we could go there. Go right ahead. Okay, let me try. Now,
conference muted.
I still didn't quite hear your question, but it sounded something like, could you talk about other aspects of the meditative life of the teacher and how to work, you know, in such a way that it's a benefit to the class? If you only did that contemplation on the children in your class, if that was all you had the time and energy for, and as I said, even doing it in the streamlined way that I suggested, in which you're just working on two or three children at the most at any time, that alone is very, very powerful. And you are, in a way, really helping that child incarnate, helping that child, you know, take hold of their physical body because of the image that you're carrying of that child. Now, other exercises that can be very helpful to the teacher, and these can be found in Steiner's basic book on the inner life called How to Know the Higher Worlds. And one of them is called the seed meditation or the seed contemplation. And he says that every day for a little while, and by a little while, Steiner means 5 minutes or less, 3 minutes, 1 minute, 30 seconds can be enough. The amount of time isn't important. What's important is the intensity and the striving of the person doing it. So for a little bit of time, you hold a seed in your hand, a seed whose identity you don't know. You don't know what's going to come out of that seed. And that's easy enough because so many seeds look alike. You hold that seed and you stare at it in a very, very focused way for a little while. And then you take back the impression of the seed and bring it back into your soul, into your inner life. So it's like a kind of breathing. And in fact, Steiner speaks of the new yoga, the yoga of the senses, in which we go out with our senses as though we're breathing out, and then we come back in. So you go out looking at the seed, you bring the impression back. You go out again, you bring it back. You just do this two or three times for a few minutes, and you do it every day for weeks, months, years, lifetimes, whatever it takes. And he says that in time, and he never tells you how much time, but it's probably not going to happen very quickly, but in time, that you will have an inner impression as you look at that seed as though you are seeing a plant beginning to sprout and grow. Now, I stress the term inner impression. You're not going to have an explosion of clairvoyant sight around the plant. The plant is not going to start looking like it's sprouting in front of your eyes. Rather, you're going to have the same inner experience that you have when in the springtime you go into your garden and there are the little cotyledons and little sprouts. There's a feeling in your soul of great joy when you see that, a kind of fulfillment that you have. That's what you start to experience with this seed. Now, why am I pointing to this exercise? He gives about 1,000 other exercises. Why this one in particular? Because, and especially, Clara, for someone like yourself, working with a child or two with special needs, you have to, every one of us as teachers, we have to be able to look at the most difficult children in our class, the ones who are hard to like and hard to love, and the ones we'd sometimes like to, you know, shake good and hard, we have to be able to look at them as though we're looking at a seed. It doesn't look like much right now. It's not very exciting, and we don't really see the value of it. But in time, over the course of time in the future, something very remarkable is going to arise. Maybe in 10 years, 50 years, in 10 lives. But somewhere along the way, that child is going to sprout just as lawfully, just as surely as that seed will. So this is why this meditation in particular can be a very good experience for us teachers to do. You'll start looking at your children differently. Not right away, but sometime in eighth grade, maybe it'll be the last day of school, I don't know. But sooner or later, something very different will come into your soul in relation to the children.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
So it's near 9 o'clock now. We've been going on for a while. If there's nothing that's really, a burning issue for you now, we can end this conference call. And if you have other questions that come up later on tonight or during the next day or two, don't hesitate, email me. I would love to be able to, start off speaking about people's questions. So even if you don't have anything tonight that you can formulate, if something comes up in the next day or two, email me, text me with a question, and I'll be happy to address them. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. And if you're having, again, trouble with the web page or any of the videos, let me know. I may be adding a little bit more in the next day or two as well, so keep an eye on the bottom of the page. There may be something new. Okay, thank you all very much. Thank you for your patience with the echoes and all the other crazy things that modern technology brought our way. I think you are wonderful to have. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Okay, good night. Good night, and we'll talk again Wednesday, same time, 7 p.m. sharp. I'll open up the call a little earlier, about 10 of Eastern Daylight Time. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks
good night.
Very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Good night.
Bye.